Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do, 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 shaboom. Life could be a dream. If I could take you up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and open with me again, boom. Ding dong, ding dong, a-lang, a-lang, a-lang. Oh, oh, oh,
with the playing of a few bars of the Chords' original version of Shaboom, it's my pleasure to introduce a TV performer, film star, and now author of one of the best books ever written on the subject of rock and roll. His long-awaited book finally hit bookstores yesterday, that is October 1st, and people throughout the country and around the world are rejoicing. Having grown up in Teaneck, New Jersey, I watched this man's TV show for years and admired him so much. The book is called Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll. Ladies and gentlemen, and this deserves a drum roll, and that's the best I can do on my budget, I am Ronnie Allen, and I am so pleased to present the legendary Clay Cole.
My goodness, what do I say after that?
All you have to do, Clay, is just take a bow.
Well, thank you, Ron. In full disclosure, I must tell your audience that we are old friends. We talk at least once a week on the phone. We email each other, and you were an enormous help in helping me compose the books. So they should know we're buddies, although we've never met face-to-face. Well, we're soon going to see each other face-to-face
at
the old-time radio's convention.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. Clay, watching you on TV for so many years, there were times that I wished I was you. I was a bit jealous, actually, watching you interview just about every well-known performer who ever rocked and rolled. And recently, I've realized some of my dreams doing the interviews I currently do. And I must tell you, Clay, I learned so much from watching you do it.
Well, isn't that nice?
It is true. Your show was different. And we are going to cover things that are in the book and are not in the book. We're going to just have some fun. I want to just read what a few people who are reasonably well known have said about you. How about this one? Back in the day, everybody in New York watched Clay Cole. Do you know who said that? Mr. Valley. Not Rudy. It was
Frankie Valley.
And then, how about this? Clay Cole, Saturday Night Rock and Roll, New York City, glued to the tube. I should know. I was there. That's a guy with only one name, four letters, Dion.
Yeah, wasn't that cool?
Yeah,
wow.
That's before he became Dion DiMucci briefly. And finally, a lady who we're going to talk about a little bit later on, because she's going to be honored in Belleville, New Jersey. Thanks for all the wonderful and warm memories. You lit up our Saturday nights and then every other night. You didn't know it, but I had a secret crush on you. Don't tell that to the National Enquirer. With admiration and affection, Connie Francis.
Well, if I'd only known she had a crush on me in those days when I was on TV, it started in 1959. I mean, she was probably the most famous female singer in the world.
Absolutely.
And to have her on my show was just like, she was a dream booking, and she did it all right. I've got pictures to prove it.
Clay, for a long time, you were kind of off the radar screen, so to speak, and you were kind of invisible, at least to most people. I know you were doing things behind the scenes, but to your major audience of rock and rollers who remembered your shows, you were kind of invisible. With the advent of the internet and with erroneous news sometimes traveling fast, it's not surprising there were rumors that you had been dead, even for 10 years. And Dionne Warwick, who's supposed to be psychic, I don't know, she once sent you a note at some point saying, "So nice to hear you are okay."
That's funny. It's true. You know, I think when any well-known person of note or anybody that has a track history or record of being slightly famous, when they finally get on the internet, they Google themselves to see, you know, if anybody's talking about them or writing about them. And when I first got my computer, I Googled Clay Cole, and I came upon a blog, "Whatever Happened to Clay Cole?" And someone named Dave, with great authority, said Clay Cole died 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, it's time to stick my neck out and start the truth. Let them know I'm still around and alive and well.
Before we talk about the book, let me just ask, why, after so many years, did you decide to put things down on paper?
Well, you know, I made a positive choice not to be visible. When I left my show, I just didn't want to be one of those guys that stick their heads into every telethon or every PBS pledge break or every supermarket opening. You know, I just thought I was going to let it rest and take the high road. And I was sort of at the end of the rope as far as being a celebrity. I didn't really enjoy it. I'm the kind of person who doesn't like to draw attention to myself, so being a celebrity wasn't really a lot of fun for me. So I just decided to lay low for 40 years or so. But when I finally moved from New York after about 43 years down to North Carolina, I found I had nothing in common with the locals because I don't fish, I don't swim, I don't sunbathe, I don't play beach blanket bingo or Catholic bingo or any kind of bingo. I don't hunt. I have no grandchildren. I really had nothing in common with folks. So I decided to build a website and then write a book. And it was the most fun that I've ever had. I mean, 4 years of writing that book was exhilarating to me because I had a reason to get up every day and, you know, work to do, and it gave me a project, and it was so much fun doing it. I mean, and of course the book never ends. It never finishes. The day the publisher says, all right, give it to me, then that ended it, but it could have gone on forever because you're constantly updating, writing, changing, thinking of new things. And so that's why I wrote the book, really, is A, to set David straight that I have not died, and number two, to give me something to do that was fun, creative, and gave me a job every day. So yeah. It was a great thrill doing it, and it's more thrilling to know that people are really liking it and really accepting it and enjoying
sure.
it. It's very gratifying.
Your website, www.claycoleshow.com. That's www.claycoleshow.com. And that word show, ladies and gentlemen, is very important.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something else that's very important. You just did it right. When I was about 16 or 17, you know, I had a TV show in Ohio.
We're going to get to
for
that.
4 years.
Oh, yeah.
15 to 19. And the station was only paying us $50 to do the show, and we had like 9 people in the cast. So the station took pity on me, and they allowed me to be the weekend booth announcer, you know, doing the station IDs and everything.
Right.
So the head announcer called me into his office one day, and he said, give me the call letters of the station. And I said, WFMJ. He said, wrong. He went to the piece of paper, and he wrote 2 U's on the piece of paper. He said, it's WFMJ. You pronounce W, no good, W, WFMJ.
Yeah.
And you just said WWW Clay Cole Show. You did it right. And I've noticed that's what separates the amateurs from the pros, because a lot of people nowadays have radio talk shows, and they say, this is WCBS, or this is W. They don't do it the real way.
Well,
you must say W. And that's a great lesson, and I never forgot it.
Thanks, Clay, and believe me, especially coming from you, that is a big compliment. You know, some people can't remember what they did a month ago, but in writing this book, which, as you say, took 4 years to do, you are remembering events from as many as 50 years ago, very, very clearly, very, very detailed. What's your secret?
I was so impressionable when I went to New York. I wanted to learn everything. I mean, I listened to everything anybody said about the rules of show business, and I listened to everything they said about how to become a New Yorker. And I absorbed all that, and I remembered clearly all the rules and all the, you know, the things that make a TV show work or show business work. And I just never forgot those things. I surprised myself when I started to write this stuff. It really amazed me that I remembered names that I hadn't thought of in years and events. But I tell you something, there's a lot of mistakes in the book. Not major mistakes. I mean, I sort of taped myself off the hook when I said, this is how I remember it. This is not an encyclopedia of rock, or this is not meant to be a fact-based research book. This is
from
what I remember.
From memory, yeah, sure.
And the mistakes are slight, but there are mistakes.
Every
in
book.
So what? Well, I get critics, like the guy who was very, very close to the run. Actually, the man who found Estelle Bennett's body and was a very close friend of all the Ronettes. And he admonished me because I say in the book the Ronettes broke up in 1965, and he said it wasn't true, they didn't break up till 66. Well, in my memory, when Ronnie married Phil Spector, he wouldn't allow her to work with the Ronettes anymore. They brought in a cousin. So the fact that Ronnie was no longer with the group, in my mind, means they're no longer the Ronettes. So he was, like, sticking to the book, you know. And there's things like that in the book that people are, you know, they won't let go of. But so what? What's
Don't worry about that. That's not important.
Yeah, that's not
and
important.
And, you know, there's an old expression, Clay. The old expression is, close enough for rock and roll.
Yeah.
So you read Clay's book. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, it's Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, and it's close enough for rock and roll. And speaking of Shaboom, the title actually has several meanings as it relates to your life and your career and to rock and roll in general. Now, the Chords version of Shaboom, we played a few bars at the outset of the show, is considered by many to be the first rock and roll record. The Crew Cuts, of course, covered it. When they hit number one, people said later on that that was the first rock and roll record to hit number one. But it was the Chords that actually did the song first.
Well, I'm not a musicologist or a music historian. I was a teenager in 1953 and 54.
Right.
And I was also on the air in 1953, 1954, doing a teenage record show.
Yes.
And the first rock and roll record that I ever heard that sent me through the roof spinning was Shaboom by the Crew Cuts.
Hey, la dee ding dong, a lang a lang a lang, boom ba do, ba do ba do ba ba. Oh, life could be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart. Hello, hello again, shaboom, and hoping we'll meet again. Oh, life could be a dream if only all my precious plans would come true.
Now, that was on purpose, because in my hometown, the disc jockey played what his sponsor, the Record Rendezvous, wanted, and he had primarily a white audience, so the disc jockey played the sanitized version. We didn't even know about the Chords that there was another version, but I flipped over the Crew Cuts record, and in my mind, that was the first rock and roll record I ever heard. And I ran right out and bought the album. And you'll recall this. It was a 33 album, but it wasn't an LP. It was a smaller version of a 33. They had smaller ones with maybe six songs on the instead of 12.
Of course, I was only 1 year old at the time.
Oh, sorry.
No, a little bit older than that, folks.
But anyway, I was glued to the album, looking at the pictures and reading the liner notes. And I was hooked from then on. The next one I remember is the Willows.
Ring.
That was the second one I remember. Oh, yeah. Thank God it's the Willows record.
Great record, and we should mention that Tony Middleton, who I had the pleasure of interviewing, did the great lead singing on that record, Church Bells.
Fantastic. And Neil Sedaka, 16-year-old, played chimes on that record.
Absolutely. That's a great piece of trivia.
Isn't
and
it?
And incidentally, speaking of Shaboom, I believe you said in the book that you had a brief radio stint at WKBN Radio in Youngstown.
Yeah.
And I think you said that the version you played was the Crew Cuts, and you had no idea at the time it was a cover.
Oh, no.
And it was the first rock and roll record that you played.
First rock and roll record I ever played. We, you know, back then we were playing Eddie Fisher, Perry Como, the Fontaine Sisters, the Cordettes, the McGuire Sisters, Patti Page. So Shaboom was actually the first record I played on the air. And following that, we did Mario Lanza's Drink, Drink, Drink from the Student Prince.
You know, what great... So, you don't have variety like that today when everything is format,
but,
you know?
Well, I talked the station into doing a show called The Varsity, because in Ohio, football, Friday night football is like, you know, enormous. Everybody goes to the high school football game. So I had a show late night on Friday that did the high school football scores and played the top tunes of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first and only radio DJ stint during football season.
You actually got your own TV show, and we're moving kind of back and forth. We're not going to be strictly chronological. We're just having fun. You got your first TV show when you were very young, and that came about because you were working with some babysitters.
Yeah. Well, I was actually writing a column. I was about 13 or 14. I approached the local newspaper about doing a teen column, and I said I'd work for nothing, and so what have they got to lose? And they allowed me to do it, and the editor was sponsoring a benefit for polio victims in those days. And he said, "You come on, you got to get an act together for this variety show. It's a charity thing." And so I picked out four of the cutest girls in high school, and we worked on a record pantomime act. We did the modern era's version of a song called Jukebox Saturday Night, in which they did impressions of Don Cornell, Les Paul and Mary Ford, Johnny Ray. So that was a hit. And then we did a Rusty Draper song called No Help Wanted, and something else. Let's walk a this away, that away. The girls did in with blacked out teeth and burlap back dresses and bare feet. We had a fun act, and it really caught on. Beyond the charity event, we were invited to do some local TV spots, and that led to us taking over one of the TV spots while the host vacationed. And then finally, the station called us and asked if we would do our very own show on Saturday night. So that began Rucker's Rumpus Room.
Rucker's Rumpus Room, and we should point out now, because some people are saying, who's Rucker?
Yeah.
Tell us who Rucker is.
Well, I'm actually Al Rucker.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my Lord, you won't believe what I'm just looking at. My cousin just walked into the room with the local paper, and my Lord, you should see this. Oh, my God, it's the whole front page of me and a great interview. Me with the Rolling Stones, me with the Net, me with the Babysitters, and the quote that I love, I was a black tie tuxedo guy lost in a tie-dye T-shirt world. That's why I left my show.
Wow.
Sorry to interrupt, but
that's okay. Interrupt any time.
It's the latest edition, and it's
my
thrilling.
My gosh, this is kind of spontaneous.
Yeah.
Like, here's a bulletin, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Okay, we got this here.
How very nice.
Now, you actually got Rucker's Rumpus Room as a result of that little variety show. That's what led directly to that.
Well, my name was Al Rucker. I was Al Rucker Jr. Back in those days, in 1953, most people decorated their basement. They wrapped it in knotty pine and put in a ping pong table or a billiard table and a bar and a hi-fi record player. And it was sort of a place to hang out, play music, and dance. So I thought Rucker's Rumpus Room had a nice alliteration to it, and it also would plant in their mind, oh, this is a place to come dance and play music. So Rucker's Rumpus Room went on the air, and it was on for 4 years every Saturday night. And we were playing Perry Como and Rosemary Clooney and McGuire's Sisters, and all of a sudden I'm playing the Everly Brothers and Chuck Berry and the Crew Cuts, and before you knew it, I'm doing a rock and roll show.
And by the way, to the rest of the country, the three R's were reading, writing, and arithmetic. But for people in Youngstown, Ohio, the three R's were Rucker's Rumpus Room.
I never thought about the three R's. That would have been a good chapter heading.
And lasted 46 weeks, I believe, because you were not sponsored.
Well, no. At the first station we worked at the CBS affiliate. We were paid nothing. And my dad built the sets. My mother built the costumes. And, of course, because we were doing a music show, the stage crew and everybody at the station was inventing new things, you know, like smoke effects and singing in the rain and dancing on clouds and flying saucers. I mean, they were trying all the new tricks because it was fun for them. It was, television was all new and exciting, black and white and live. But they were paying us nothing, so we finally had to say goodbye to the station. As it turned out, the very next day we were doing a charity party for the Rotary Club, and a man approached us and saying, how would you like to be on the NBC station, and they'll pay you $50 a week? Well, we didn't miss a beat. The very next week we were on the NBC station, and the cast of nine of us now were making $50. So we had
the cast of nine. Now, you had the Babysitters. They were part of that. And who were the others?
Well, eventually we had to get four guys because there was the Hilltoppers, the Four Lads, the Four Aces, the Four Coins. Yeah, we had to have four guys do all the vocal group hits. And then we had big production numbers, too. We would always do, like, a football show, a theme show, or a senior prom show, or a hayride show, or, you know, Halloween, Christmas. We did 92 Christmas shows, but that went on forever. So we needed boys, you know, so we finally talked four guys into doing it, and they were called the Collegians.
Okay.
So we had a cast of nine, the four Babysitters, the four Collegians, and myself.
And yourself. Okay.
Yeah. And by the way, this is fun, because I am now calling you from Ohio, and tomorrow is our high school reunion, and I have arranged a reunion with the Babysitters.
Oh, that's great.
We haven't seen each other in 52 years, and most of them haven't seen each other in 52 years.
That is fantastic.
And we all have scrapbooks to show, and I have logs from all the old Rumpus Room shows, yeah. So we're going to get together for a private reunion.
Now, back then, they didn't have videotape. Do you have any audio tapes of those shows?
No, nothing.
Oh,
just a lot of still photos. They couldn't even afford kinescopes. I mean, there was no tape till the mid-60s. We were live in black and white.
Well, as we're gonna mention, one of the great tragedies of rock and roll is all of these great shows, TV shows and stage shows, there's virtually no footage whatsoever. Just shame on people for not recording history.
Jumping ahead, WPIX was truly the villain because we had such historic shows. I mean, we were the only show ever in the world to have the Rolling Stones and the Beatles on the same show.
Yeah,
and they repeated that hour on three different nights and three different time slots, and the ratings were through the roof. Then they erased and recorded over that show.
Let me just put out a call for anybody. We're doing this interview for the Jersey Girl Sing website, www.jerseygirlsing.com. And any of you out there who may have been around, I'm not expecting that you have any videotapes, but maybe you've got audio tapes of some of these things. If you have audio tapes of anything, they could send them to you, right, Clay? Audio
yeah,
tapes?
Sure.
You have a public address, which is The Clay Cole Show. With the mailing address, it's the Clay Cole Show at yahoo.com.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, The Clay Cole Show at yahoo.com. So if any of you out there have any audio tapes of anything that Clay has ever done, he will be most interested to hear from you.
Let me add one more thing. When the Rolling Stones were on my show, there was a photograph taken. I said something that's funny, obviously, because Nick and the whole, they're all just in garrulous laughter. They're just hysterical at something I said. And that photo circulated. In fact, I had it blown up 5 feet by 4 feet for one of my clubs that I ran one time.
Wow.
Had it on the cover of the invitations. It was a very popular photo, and now I cannot find that photo, and I've searched and begged and looked everywhere. So if anybody's got an invitation that has that on the cover or anything of that Rolling Stone picture.
Well,
all the Stones pictures I have, they look so dour, but it was because they had just arrived in America the night before, and they stayed up all night going to the government lounge
so
they were exhausted when they rolled into my show.
We're going to move forward now. At some point, you decided to try to make it in the Big Apple. What made you decide to take that chance?
Well, I had done 4 years in Youngstown. I had also taken singing lessons and soft shoe lessons and elocution lessons and speech lessons. It's like I did 4 years of college because I was on the air 4 years and I did all the local teachers singing and dancing. And I wanted to get to New York and really wanted to be an actor, musical comedy actor, singing, dancing. So I had an offer in 1957 to go to Buffalo to be a disc jockey or just go to New York and try my luck. And I decided I'd just go to New York and try my luck. And I gave myself 10 years. I thought, if I don't make it in 10 years, then I'll go back to Hubbard and I'll write for the local newspaper. And fortunately, I had a great time. I mean, even though I was starving in New York for 2 years, I worked as an NBC page,
right. Which
I got to work the Jack Parr show for the first full year of that, the most exciting year when he walked off the show and there was all this headlines and controversy. Then I worked for Jack Berry and Dan Enright, who produced quiz shows, and I was working for them when they were caught with their
whatever TV, down.
fixing the game shows.
A little bit, yeah.
Then I got on television in New York, and I was on the air in September. November, Alan Freed was fired for the Paola investigation and that scandal. So I was in the midst of, Jack Parr, the quiz show scandal, and the Alan Freed Paola.
Wow. I got to ask you a question about Alan Freed,
uh-huh.
Because it seems to me, and of course you have a whole chapter in this book devoted to the Paola thing. It's called Paola Scandal 1959. It's chapter 6. I have always wondered why Alan Freed sort of like took the fall for just about everybody.
I loved Alan Freed. He was so kind to me. As a matter of fact, he gave me one of his apartments to live in until I got settled. He was just a gentleman. He helped promote my show before I even went on the air. He couldn't have been nicer to me. I had nothing bad to say about Alan, but, there was this factor there. He hung out with a disreputable crowd. He did put his name on records that he didn't write. He had copyrights and the Paola thing. Even though it was not illegal
That's interesting, yeah.
It was not illegal. There was no law saying you couldn't accept money to play a record. The mainstream of the music business thought that payola was what was keeping rock and roll alive, and they thought if we get rid of payola, rock and roll will go away. They didn't understand that that was going to be the music of America.
Right.
So the record company people and the songwriters like Johnny Mercer and great stars like Frank Sinatra and Jimmy Durante all poo-pooed. It's all payola. That's why rock and roll is still on the air. Once we get rid of rock and roll and payola, we'll get back to regular music.
Yeah.
But they were wrong.
Yeah, you know,
Alan suffered. He became the scapegoat.
I know, and it really is a shame.
Yeah.
Because he did so much
yeah.
for the music.
Now, Tony Bennett rebelled. He just told Mr. Miller, you know, you cannot give me this crap to sing. I want to sing the great standards. But do you know, this is a little-known fact, Tony Bennett was being marketed as a rock and roll star by Columbia Records. They needed somebody.
Yeah.
They had nobody. Johnny Ray, his time was over, unfortunately. He was big in 52.
That's right. He had, was like passé. But
unfortunately,
they had Tony Bennett do records like In the Middle of an Island.
Exactly. Well, anyway, he rebelled. But before that, he actually did an Alan Freed 10-day show at the Paramount.
Wow.
I mean, the New York Paramount.
Yeah.
And Tony Bennett told me that he couldn't sing over the screaming. He said he almost had strep throat. He said, I've never experienced anything like that in my life.
Wow.
But it's true. He once, because they pushed him into trying to be their teenage idol, actually did a Freed show. With
yeah.
the
of course, line. He eventually had things like San Francisco, which I guess is his signature song.
Yeah.
And even after that, though, he became for a while the darling of the MTV crowd. He was doing MTV Unplugged and that sort of stuff.
He's very smart.
Yeah. Before you actually made it to New York, you kind of did it by way of Providence. You were doing a show at WJAR
mm-hmm.
in Providence, and one of the pages actually was responsible for making that connection. I think the page's name was Tom Pyle.
Yeah, Tom Pyle was fascinated by the Rumpus Room show I did in Ohio. He had wanted to hear all the details and everything. So finally one day he said, do you mind if I go out and try to pitch the idea to a state? And I said, no, go ahead, thinking nothing could possibly happen. But he was from Fisher's Island, which is off the coast of Rhode Island, and he went to the Providence station and sold the idea, pitched it, and they said, yeah, sounds good. We'll do it on Saturday night. So
wow.
We rehearsed the show in New York at different people's apartments during the week, and we would drive up to Providence early Saturday morning, rehearse all day, do the show live at 7, and then drive back to Manhattan that night.
Wow.
So we did that for about a year, and that's actually how Alan Freed's son-in-law found out about me. The ratings were so good, he said, let me check this guy out, what this is all about, and brought me to New York and then set up the Rate the Records audition, and that's how I got the show.
Before you started doing that show, you changed your name from Albert Rucker Jr. to Clay Cole. And you got the name Clay Cole from a distant cousin, and the details of that are in the book. The show was called Rate the Records. Initially, it was on WNTA, which was Channel 13, that eventually became WNET, I believe.
Well, it was in...
This was 59, I believe.
September 10th, 1959.
Right.
That was last month, would make 50 years.
Oh, I didn't even...
59, this is 2009.
This is almost the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
A little bit more than the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, one month, yeah. Last month, September yeah. 10th.
Was Rate the Records a show that was strictly a record rating show? Was that the entire format of the
yeah,
show?
Yeah, and it was just awful. Two panels of high school kids would come on, and sometimes there would be celebrity panels just occasionally, but mostly it was two high schools, and we would play a brand new release.
Right.
The kids in the studio would dance to it, and then the panels would rate it, and then we'd compare it to the Cashbox Billboard ratings.
Right.
But, you know, I was very itchy. It was, that format was too dull for me, and I begged the station, please, let's break out of this dull format. You know.
How many times can you hear the words, it's great to dance to, or I can't dance to it?
I like the beat.
Yeah. Not too much originality. But the show did well ratings-wise, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, the show was fine. And they agreed with me to change the format, and they allowed me to do a more freewheeling show, which then the show really took off. I mean,
and what sort of freewheeling? What did you add to the show?
Well, it was just a style. We weren't locked into that horrible format, and it was open to much more guest stars. I mean, my goodness, that's when Connie came on and Bobby Darin. The Isley Brothers invited me to do a Shout, and Dinah Washington came by. I mean, one time we did a home audience question. We said, we're going to play a tune. If you could tell us who sings this tune, send in a postcard and you win a record album. First 50 people or something. Well, we got 14,000 postcards in 3 days. And the station said, oh my goodness, we better give this guy a Saturday show. So I was only on the air 2 months and I got the hour on Saturday night.
Right.
And then that was the big show. I mean, that was the show.
The Saturday show. Now, was there dancing on these shows?
So
it was dancing and lip syncing of the hits.
Saturday night was more of a variety show. I mean, that's, you know, there was like 8 or 10 acts on the Saturday show. But dancing, the audience for the Saturday show were all the dance contest winners from the Monday through Friday show.
Wow.
All the best dancers got tickets to come to the Saturday show. That was sort of an incentive. The Saturday show was really the big show for me. Saturday night was always my night.
But meanwhile, you said a few moments ago that you'd never really felt comfortable being a celebrity, but you must have enjoyed a lot of what you were doing.
Oh, don't get me wrong. In the beginning, it was terrific. I mean, my first year, I broke all-time records at the Brooklyn Paramount Theater with a show that had so many stars on it, I couldn't even begin to tell you now. I made a movie. I made a record. I was on TV 6 nights a week. I mean, that 1960 and 61 were years of firsts for me. And I mean, I did one of each. I mean, all my dreams were fulfilled in those years.
Well, there's something called Palisades Amusement Park that was a part of that scene.
Oh, of course.
And Palisades
the
Amusement
of 60,
Park.
That's
magical.
People remember me from that so much. It's so unbelievable. But we were on an hour a day, 6 days a week from Palisades.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, I would go and do the free act stage.
These were live shows.
Yeah, the live
shows. And I remember I used to go to Palisades Park all the time, and I never had the courage to go up and shake your hand. I was a nervous kid. I wish I had. The people there are just like a who's who of rock and roll. There's a guy by the name of Ernest Evans, good old Ernie. And actually, prior to doing the twist, he had actually had a hit record using the name Chubby Checker. Was it Dick Clark's wife gave him the name Chubby Checker? I'm not sure.
Yeah, she's credited with it. I think it was Tony Mamarella, his producer.
It might have been. I wasn't sure.
The wife gets credit.
At any rate, Chubby Checker, I believe that you were the first to present Chubby Checker on television doing something called The Twist.
That's absolutely true. July of 1960.
I kind of remember Chubby Checker was promoting a song called Toot. My baby's got the cutest little toot. But that wasn't the side that got all the attention. The side that got the attention was something called The Twist. And Chubby was not the first person to twist. Hank Ballard wrote the song and did the original version of The Twist.
You know, Chubby covered it, and it was the B-side, just as you say. But we wanted Chubby to do more than one song on the show, so we asked him, can we flip the record over and do The Twist? He said, sure, but he had never seen Hank Ballard do The Twist. He had never performed The Twist.
Right.
So he just made up what he thought was The Twist. And so he sang The Twist, danced The Twist, to perform The Twist first on my show ever. And the rest is history.
Oh, my gosh.
An explosion that you can hear around the world.
There's actually The Twist Part 1 and The Twist Part 2, because Chubby's record became the only record in the rock era to hit number one on the chart, not once, but twice.
Number one.
And speaking of Palisades Amusement Park, you introduced a lot of people there.
Over the period of 5 or 6 years, I think everybody who ever stepped into a recording studio eventually ended up on the pre-act stage at Palisades Park. It was incredible. And you could see it free. That's why we called it the free act stage. The acts didn't get paid, and the audience didn't have to pay to see it. Well, the payback for the artist was that Irving Rosenthal, the owner, manager, would send an army of these paper hangers out in the middle of the night. They would strike all the empty buildings, sidewalks, blocks, blockades, you know, any place you could hang a sign. And it was always a huge picture and a rundown of who's on the show that week. Fabian or Bobby Rydell or Clint Eastwood or whoever was going to be there, plus the rundown of supporting acts. So everybody got a lot of promotion. My picture was in neighborhoods of people who never would consider watching a rock and roll show. It was like I was plastered all over town.
But it didn't say wanted. You weren't like on a wanted poster.
No. I was very much wanted.
But in a good way. In a good way. In the meantime, with all this hubbub, you met with a guy named Sid Bernstein, and you had the opportunity to do something that you had never done before, and namely, we're talking about the Brooklyn Paramount.
So strange you say that, because just 3 or 4 days ago, I was having dinner with my brother down in Myrtle Beach, and the phone rang, and a voice said, "Clay, you know who this is? Guess who this is?" And I mean, I'm thinking of a zillion people that I knew in my life. And he said, "It's Sid Bernstein." And I hadn't talked to Sid in 40 years. He was so sweet. Out of the blue, he just called me. And I said, "Sid, you're all over my book. I've got to send it to you." And, he's 92 or 93.
Wow.
And we were really good pals. And I knew him before he even met his wife, Jerry. But
Now
they have like 9 kids, and just a couple of grandchildren came into their lives this year. So he's as happy as a lark. And we're doing the Beatle Expo together November 29th. Up in Stamford, Connecticut, an all-day Beatles convention and trade show and vendors and marketing and merchandising. So I'll get to see Sid in person again.
Right. Well,
great man.
Sid did something for you. He arranged for you to MC a 10-day stint at the Brooklyn Paramount Theater. Now, the headliners on these shows, there were actually 3 headliners, and each of them performed for a few of those days. The 3 headliners were Brenda Lee, Ray Charles, and Bobby Rydell. And the other acts that appeared on the bill over the 10-day stint were Dion, Neil Sedaka, The Drifters, The Coasters, The Skyliners, Johnny Burnett, The Shirelles, Chubby Checker, Kathy Young, Bobby V, Bo Diddley, Jimmy Charles, The Delicates, Dante and the Evergreens, Little Anthony and the Imperials, and A Partridge in a Pear Tree. Basically, Clay, you'd have to say it was kind of a who's who of rock and roll.
Well, if you tried to put that show together today, which is impossible, you can't, but it would cost millions of dollars. I mean, can you imagine Dion and Neil Sedaka and Kathy Young and Bobby V and Johnny Burnett and all those people
all in the same
supporting
place?
Roles with Little Anthony, The Drifters, The Coasters. I mean, it's what an incredible show.
It was so special.
Well, of course, we broke all records.
That was the next thing. Yes, you sure did. You broke all existing records. The records you broke still stand today.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, I'm proud of that.
How did a Brooklyn Paramount show work? There were like 4 of them a day?
Well, we did, I believe, 4 a day and 5 on weekends. I recall vividly one night, I think it was probably on our weekend show, our 12 midnight show would get out about 1:30, quarter to 2. And as we left the theater out the stage door, there would be a line around the block waiting for the first show in the morning. And we're just leaving. I mean, it was incredible. They're standing out in the freezing cold, waiting to get into the first show in the morning, and we just finished the last show of the night.
Yeah. You had a little embarrassing incident occur during one of those shows where something you didn't...
Well, you talk about where my fly was.
Since you brought it up,
Clay... No, you got to read the book. I won't tell that story.
But there is a story about that. That's good. We don't have to tell the story here. Read the book, and let me just tell people once again what the book is called before we proceed. The book is called Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 through 1968. The book is available in bookstores, Amazon.com, Borders, Barnes & Noble, and all over the place. So you were kind of on top of the world at that point. You just had so many things going for you. And if that wasn't enough, you actually had also made a movie about the twist. And the movie was called...
Twist Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, twist around the clock. Come on, everybody, let's twist. Hey, hey, come on, everybody, let's twist.
Everybody's doing the twist. Yeah, it goes like this. Where you shake that thing, you round and round, and you lift your leg up and down, and you twist around the clock.
Come on, everybody, let's twist. Hey, hey, come on, everybody, let's twist.
Chubby Checker was in it?
Of course. Chubby Checker, Dion, the Marcells, and Vicki Spencer, who was a real hot 16-year-old gal. She just did a movie with Jimmy Clanton called Teenage Millionaire, and we still keep in touch. I talk to her once a week.
I interviewed her, and
somebody
named Clay Cole actually called in during that interview.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You see what it is, folks. Clay remembers things from 50 years ago, but 6 months ago, a little bit more difficult.
Oh, that's a senility sign. Uh-oh.
Vicky's a great person.
Yeah, she is.
In Twist Around the Clock, they kind of took liberties as far as what the real story was of the twist. Didn't they have, like, you inventing it or something?
Well, yeah, it was really dumb because I thought the real story would have been much better centering it around Chubby. But Chubby actually did a guest performance, a couple of tunes in the show, and Dion the same. But we did a big finale together, which was fun. Me and Chubby and Dion and the Marcells and Vicky.
Wow.
In fact, that's the first thing we shot. They brought in, maybe 200 extras all dressed in evening gowns and tuxedos sitting at tables. And they told me, just ad lib it, introduce, you know, Dion like you're doing on your TV. So my first day on the set was in front of an audience of extras sitting in a nightclub, and I'm ad libbing my way through the performances. But it was fun. It was just great.
Must have been.
Most exciting. I mean, I met so many stars and celebrities. The interesting thing is that the twist was so big and the Peppermint Lounge was so world famous that everybody in Hollywood wanted to know stories about the Peppermint Lounge and about the twist. Kids today won't understand, but it was a huge phenomenon. All over the world, everybody was twisting. Fellini movies, and Jimmy Stewart took it to the Mr. Hobbs movies, and Phil Silvers took it to Broadway on his Do Re Mi musical. I mean, everybody was just twist crazy.
It was when the twist was done at some place called the Peppermint Lounge. Somebody wrote about it. Was it Charlie Knickerbocker?
Charlie Knickerbocker, yeah, the society columnist for the New York Journal.
Not his real name. It was Igor Cassini?
Yeah, Igor Cassini.
And he wrote a column. Pretty soon everybody was twisting. Even Frank Sinatra was twisting. Everybody's twisting. He did that record.
Yeah, well, everybody made twist records. Connie Francis did, Bobby Darin did, Ray Charles made a twist record, The Ventures, the Bill Black Combo. Everybody rushed out a twist album. It was incredible. Phenomenal. Yeah.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and I am so pleased to be talking with a man who just about anybody who ever watched TV in New York City in the late 50s and early 60s, everybody knows this gentleman, Mr. Clay Cole. I want to talk about one of the subtle features of your book. That's something that's probably not going to be mentioned in too many interviews, but you have an interesting page, which is XXI. I'm not going to ask you to remember what's on XXI. I'm going to tell you. You have a definition of rock and roll, and rock and roll, according to this definition, is a pop music genre originating in the 1950s, a blend of black rhythm and blues with white country western. Rock is a generic term for the range of styles that evolved out of rock and roll. And what I find interesting about this page is you have all kind of the pop and the jazz and the non-rock singers kind of at the top, and you have like different categories like bluegrass, jive, bebop, pop singers, gospel. Then you have rock and roll, and you kind of subdivided rock and roll into all the categories that make up rock and roll. And we're talking about, I'm just estimating, about 30 different categories here. 1950s rhythm and blues, rockabilly, doo-wop, teen idols, 1960s pop, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you did was you took just about everybody who was important in rock and roll and you assigned them to a category. And that's interesting. For example, you put Elvis Presley in the rockabilly category. He could also have been 1960s pop, but each one gets his own category. And I just found that very interesting, what you did on that page.
I wish I could have expanded on that and added more names. and I think in the second printing I will, because there's room in there for more.
Gosh.
I mean, Wanda Jackson, for instance, is not in the rockabilly. I wanted her in there. I wasn't quite sure as a novice at the printing game how many names I could fit on a page, but I could see that I could add more, and I'm going to try next time.
But wasn't it difficult to determine, like, where you put somebody, like, determining where would you put Elvis Presley, for example?
Well, to me, he was a rockabilly star.
Rockabilly.
I always define rock and roll in this way. Country and Western, knocked up rhythm and blues, and the bastard child was rock and roll. You know, it's as simple as you can put it. Rock and roll emerged out of white country Western and black rhythm and blues.
Right.
Bill Haley was called Bill Haley and his Saddlemen. worked at a club for 14 months down in New Jersey. They loved rhythm and blues, black rhythm and blues. In that club is where he developed that style of combining country, the Saddlemen, with rock and roll. And, of course, he changed his name instead of Bill Haley and the Saddlemen to Bill Haley and the Comets.
Interesting thing about Bill Haley and the Comets and Rock Around the Clock, if you have an original Decca Records pressing of Rock Around the Clock, it says it's a foxtrot. It's amazing.
Yes.
I'm not making that up.
Yes, they used to do that. They used to always put on the label. You're absolutely right. You brought back a flash. They would put on there what kind of dance it is, a foxtrot or a rumba or a waltz. They would tell you on there, you know, what the record's all about. That's so clever of you. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But I would have thought it was a jitterbug or something. I never would have thought that that was a...
Well, it was a Lindy hop.
It was actually a Lindy.
Which became the bop.
Yeah.
The bop.
But
yeah.
I just thought it was kind of fun because, you see, foxtrot, that kind of implies it's not really, what's this rock and roll thing? It's a pop record, you know? It's like...
Exactly.
I spent several, maybe a couple of hours just looking at this page and looking at all these names and I'm saying... Oh, this is so interesting. You know, is everybody here? I checked to see if you put any name into two categories, but I don't think you did. I think everybody gets just one category.
Well, Dion sort of got two. He was part of the doo-wop group, and then he became a teenage
idol. Oh, okay.
Idol,
he was with Dion and the Belmonts.
I think maybe Dion got two slots, but then I'm partial because I have such great affection for Dion.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's lived a marvelous life, and he's always in a constant search for perfection in his work, and I admire him so much.
Everything was so great, and then something happened, and it was beyond your control that the station got sold.
This was quite a surprise because I was on a roll. I was on Channel 13, which was then called WNTA, and I was on 7 days a week at that time. We were doing the Monday through Friday show. We were doing the Saturday night variety show, and I was doing a Sunday afternoon new talent show. And one day they called all of us into the studios in Newark. It was every employee, secretaries, engineers, everybody. And Eli Landau, the chairman of WNTA, announced that we had sold to Public Broadcasting, and we would all just be out of work. And that was, you know, right after my movie, right after my stage show, right after all my great successes. I mean, I was really on a roll, and it came to a screeching halt because suddenly I was off the air and out of work.
Well, you lost more than the TV show. You were supposed to MC the Easter show at the Brooklyn Paramount, and even though you broke all records at the Christmas show, 1960, they decided, well, you didn't have the clout of the TV show, so they got, was it Murray the K, I believe they got for that
Murray
one.
The K, yeah.
Murray the K.
Yeah, that was a blow, but I understood the business decision Sid Bernstein had to make, but it was a crushing blow to me. But, you know, it was the whole thing was a crushing blow and a lesson.
Well, we want to point out that you were down, but not for the count. The count only reached 8, and then you got up. You got another show, WPIX.
Well, in between there, though, while I was out of work, my agent at William Morris said, based on your movie, why don't we send you out on the road with a show called Twisterama? By the way, a title I hated. It sounded like an amusement park ride. But, you know, okay, Clay Cole's Twisterama. And we hired a band, a wonderful show band called Lou Dane and the Furies. And I brought in the Capris, who were very good friends of mine. We worked up an act. And we needed ladies for the show. And Roz Ross, my agent at William Morris, said, I saw these three girls at the Peppermint Lounge dancing. Why don't you give them a try? So in walked Ronnie, Nedra, and Estelle without an act, but, you know, with a nice booty. And we worked on an act together. I found out that Ronnie could do an impression of Pearl Bailey. We put that in, and I taught them What I Say and Hit the Road, Jack. And before you know it, we had a review, and it was me, the Capris, and the Ronettes, and we played the 500 Club in Atlantic City, and we did the Latin Quarter with a big, big charity show with Ethel Merman and Liberace, and we were, you know, hot stuff for a while. And then the three girls couldn't travel out of the country. They were very young, and we had some bookings out of the country, so the Ronettes left, signed a Cole Picks record deal. They had 5 songs that never went anywhere. And the Delicates, who had been on my show many, many times at the Brooklyn Paramount and on TV, stepped in. It was Peg and Denise Ferry and Peg Santivia. And we continued on for maybe another 6 months with the Twistorama show. And then I was hired to do Miss Teenage America at the Freedom Land and a Teenage World's Fair they put on. It was three specials for WOR. And then Channel 11 called and said, come on over, let's talk about a teenage show. And so before you know it, I'm back on the air with Channel 11.
Sounds like you didn't have too much time to cry over spilled milk when you lost that other show. I mean, you just
who could afford milk? Are you kidding?
You bounced
back. Forget about spilling it.
Well, you bounced back pretty quickly. And the show on WPIX, what was that show called?
It started out as a talk show. They wanted me to do sort of like a Johnny Carson show for young people. It was called The Young World of Clay Cole. Now, our first guest, by the way, was my idol, Steve Allen, and his wife, Jane Meadows. Mm-hmm. And Bobby Darin agreed to do the first show, and Chuck McCann was my sidekick. But as usual, I have a very short attention span, and I wanted to kick out of that locked-in format and, again, get back to a more freewheeling show. So they simply called it the Clay Cole Show and let me do whatever I wanted.
And then you brought in, like, an audience and stuff like that.
Yeah, brought in the audience.
That's what you missed. You kind of missed that, didn't you, with the talk show format?
You missed the
audience.
And actually, the very first thing we did a wild thing for 1 year. We had a segment at the end of the show called Clay's Coal Bin, where all the acts on the show would do comedy sketches or blackouts or, shtick. And they loved it. The acts just loved it because it gave them, you know, a whole new thing to do. We did a whole Christmas show with the Young Rascals, where they acted out the whole Night Before Christmas in their nightgowns and caps, and Sid Bernstein was Santa Claus, you know, which is an inside joke right away, a Jewish Santa Claus.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sitting in this big chair like Alastair Cook, you know, reading the famous story as they were acting it out. I mean, we did this bizarre, wild, crazy.
Tell me a little bit about Chuck McCann. What was he like?
Well, he taught me everything that I needed to know about comedy. He was an absolutely brilliant man. You know, he taught me about attitude and, you know, how much the right costume can convey such a message as to who you are quickly. And we worked together beautifully. He's a really sensitive guy, really sweet man, and I'm going to see him also after many, many years at the Friends of Old Time Radio convention.
And at the end of the show, we're going to talk about that because you got two major events coming up, and you're going to have a very, very busy weekend on the weekend of the 23rd and the 24th, a part of that, and maybe also include the Friday. We're going to talk about that at the very end because you got two major events coming up. Clay, there were a few specific shows that I'd like to talk briefly about, and we'll have like a little musical interlude to bring them on. So here's the first one.
I will follow him wherever he may go. There isn't an ocean too deep, a mountain so high it can keep me away.
Little Peggy March. And I will follow him. Little Peggy March had a very interesting experience. She walked into the studio with one name, and she ended your show with a different name.
Well, she'll never forget me because she hated the name Little Peggy March. Record companies will sometimes give you a tag, and you're stuck with it. But when she turned 16, it was on my show, and I conspired with her mother. We presented her with a cake, and it had Little Peggy March on the top, and whipped cream, the little, had a big cross. We crossed out the Little Peggy March. From that moment on, she became Peggy March.
Yeah.
And she still remembers that to this day. I heard from her recently this year, and she laughed about that as a turning point in her life. She's a great gal.
That may have been another first. I can't think of any other case where a person walked onto a show with one name and walked out with a different name.
That's
funny. And Clay, you are a man of firsts.
Of firsts.
I want to be your lover, but your friend is all I stay. I'm only halfway to paradise, so near yet so far away. I long for your lips to kiss my
Tony Orlando. Orlando had never been on television, and Epic was promoting him in four-page ads and Billboard and cash boxes as the next big teen idol, and he was going to debut his song, Halfway to Paradise, on my show. And we were promoting him for like 3 or 4 weeks. Coming up, Tony Orlando in 3 weeks, or 2 weeks, or 1 week, and finally the show, and we decided we'd put him on last to build the suspense. But two things happened. The assistant director mistimed the show, so when it came time for Tony, we were already overtime and had like 10 seconds to go. And a second error happened. The audio man put the wrong side of the record up. So I very proudly said, and here he is for his first time on television, Tony Orlando. And the camera hit him with a close-up. The record played the wrong side. And the credit roll for the end of the show started rolling over his face. And he got about 5 seconds into the song, and we went to black. And that was his debut.
What did he do? Did he actually start? He actually started lip-syncing the wrong side.
He just stood there dumbfounded, but he knew what had happened, and he started lip-syncing the
wrong side.
The wrong side, but the credits were directed by, produced by. You know, the credits are rolling over his face, and boom, we went off the air.
Well, I remember a similar thing happening on no less than the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have an audio tape of it. He had a lot of singers on this show. Mm-hmm. And the last singer was supposed to be Sam Cooke. And the last thing you heard, okay, here he is. I can't really do Ed Sullivan, but here he is, ladies and gentlemen, America's popular singer, Sam Cooke. And all you hear is, you send me. And then, this is the CBS television network. I remember that. So you had your own little Ed Sullivan moment there with Tony Orlando.
That's television for you.
Yeah, but you brought back Tony, and Tony did get a chance to...
Oh, yeah, the next week we brought, with great apologies, we brought him back.
Yeah.
But can you imagine the embarrassment? I mean, his mother and father and aunts and uncles and all the neighborhood are gathered around the TV to see the debut of their little booby, and he's on for 5 seconds and it's over with. I mean, how embarrassing that was. But we laugh about it. He's been my lifelong friend, you know.
Well, let's go from Tony to Tony.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me to be where little cable cars climb halfway to the stars. The morning fog may chill the air. I don't care.
The story with Tony, I was sitting in a popular restaurant with show folks and TV people with Danny's Hideaway, and I happened to notice Tony Bennett sitting alone over in a corner. You know, he's a celebrity, and I was interested. I was watching him. And when he finished his dinner, he paid his check, and he got up, and he wandered over to Henry Fonda's table and paid his respects to Fonda, you know, and I'm watching him. I thought, oh, gee, how polite that is. He suddenly turned and looked right in my eyes, and he started to walk right to my table. I said, oh, my God, he's coming to me. He laid his hand on his shoulder. He looked down at me. He says, Clay, when are you going to have me on your show? Can you imagine? I said, are you kidding, Tony? Anytime you want. He said, well, how about next week?
And you did a one-hour show with him, was it?
Yeah,
was
we one did. Hour? The only guest for one full hour. We did a whole hour with Tony Bennett.
Amazing.
He couldn't have been nicer. I mean, talk about nice guys. But he knows how to market. See, he did this same thing with my show back in the 60s as he did with MTV. He ingratiated himself with the young crowd and won a whole new audience. He's very, very smart about marketing his abilities, and he's a great entertainer.
He is. And when he did your show, I think you described in the book that you were actually sitting on a chair while he was doing some of these songs.
Yeah, we sat on stools
very
together in front of
him. Informal.
We did everything live.
Yeah.
We brought in his quartet, I think it was. And, you know, it was a very breezy hour. We chatted between songs, and he sang, and I just sat there, you know, next to him, just drooling.
Great performer. But he was never really a rock and roller, though.
No.
By any
He did up-tempo songs, but they were not rock and roll. Yeah, his forte was concerts.
I would think so.
Nobody better in front of a big band than Tony Bennett. I mean, he knows how to please an audience. He works. He really works.
I remember that Sinatra once said that Sinatra, considered Bennett the greatest singer.
You're absolutely right. That's a famous and well-known quote.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and as I said, Clay has been responsible for a lot of firsts. And here is what many consider to be the firstest first in terms of importance. You were the first to present the Rolling Stones on American TV. How, pray tell, did that come about?
I was on a 30-theater tour with the Dave Clark Five. They had arranged strategically planned restaurants where we could take breaks, and I was sitting in a German restaurant up in Germantown by 86th Street RKO Theater having my sauerbraten, and a very elegant man with a goatee came, "Beg your pardon," he said, "I'm so sorry to interrupt your lunch." He said, "But I'm from London Records." And he says, "But any chance would you consider putting the Rolling Stones on your show?" And I took a swig of my beer to try not to show my... I looked at him and I said, "I think we could work that out." And he was from London Records. And Peter Noon actually told me, it's a famous quote of his, but he said, "When all of us left England, we were told, you must do Ed Sullivan and you must do Clay Cole." And he said, "But when we arrived, we didn't know who was who." So, but then Peter in my book says, "So we did Clay Cole and then Ed came around."
Yeah.
But it was easy as that. It was like Tony Bennett saying, "Hey, Clay, when am I going to be on your show?" The Rolling Stone just said, "Can we do your show?" And I said, "You can." Coincidentally, our sister station in Chicago had permission to tape the Beatles in concert in Chicago. So they wired us, would we be interested in the Beatles? And I thought, oh my goodness, we'll do the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. So I set the theme, it would be the Beatles versus the Rolling Stones. Now, of course, it wasn't really a battle of the bands. It was just a good promotional hook for the show.
Yeah.
But we had the Stones live in the studio and the Beatles via satellite from Chicago. The only show in history to have both of them on at the same time. And, of course, the Rolling Stones were on for the first time ever in America on my show. And then they came back and did more, you know. But I think, you know, people at that time, there was two camps. There was the Beatles camp and the Rolling Stones camp. And I was asked by a reporter in the Daily News who I thought would have the longevity, which of the groups. And I did say the Rolling Stones because I thought they were gritty. They were singing black man's blues songs. They were really into that Delta Swamp music. Like they did Little Red Rooster on my show, which was Sam Cooke, Chuck Berry. They've all recorded
the kind of a blues type of song.
Yes, exactly. They were a blues band, and they were funky. You know, they wore really ratty clothes, and they looked like street urchins, and they smelled like street urchins. That's a whole other story. And the Beatles were, you know, these shiny mohair suits with little velvet collars and the pointy shoes and the clean cut, you know, and the Stones were like this grungy street gang right out of Clockwork Orange. So I think New Yorkers kind of like the Rolling Stones. They like that grittiness. They like the blues. They like that edge that they had. So I was right when I said, when they asked me who would last longer, I said the Rolling Stones, and they proved to be right.
They're still performing, aren't they?
Well, the thing really is, I mean, the Beatles admitted, they said, "Look, we're not good musicians," and they weren't. They weren't great, great musicians, but they were incredibly inspired songwriters. The Beatles were successful because of their great songs and concept albums, and the Stones because they were the greatest rock and roll band ever.
Is there any other show that is like kind of memorable? Well, I'm going to mention one other show.
You girl, you like to be left alone, you're the one to love, you never hold.
did a one-hour salute to Motown?
Well, I had a controversy going with my station. They were admonishing me for having too many black performers on the show. And I took offense to that, and I paid no attention. I kissed Dionne Warwick, hugged the Shiraz. I kissed Sammy Davis, for God's sake, you know. Threw a pie in Lloyd Price's face. They must have loved that. But, you know, I embraced black performers. I worked the Apollo Theater 3 different weeks, once with Fats Domino, once with Gladys Knight and the Pips, and once with, oh, we did an all-girls show, I remember.
Wow.
Yeah, well, anyway, I was a welcomed act at the Apollo. They loved me, and I always was at the forefront of presenting black performers and black audience members on our show. Well, the station said I have too many blacks, and I got to stop that. Well, I didn't pay any attention to it. I decided I'm going to mount the biggest black show ever in the history of television. Up to that time, it was. I had an all-Motown show. Every artist on the show was black, including the comedian, Willie Tyler and Lester, who had Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight, Marvelettes, Martha the Vandellas. I mean, you name it, they were all on for a full hour of
Wow.
And that was historic at that time. And it was the first time ever of an all-black variety show presented by a white host.
What about, and I'm talking about over the years, not just relating now to the Motown show, but like over the years that you were with these various shows, you introduced a lot of acts on TV for the first time. Was it the record companies that came to you and said, we got this new up-and-coming, this guy's not on the chart yet, but we think he's up-and-coming, could he be on the show? Did they actually come to you and offer their services?
Yeah, well, there was a series of promotion men that worked for the distributor or the record company, and they would visit my office once a week and play me the new tunes. And, you know, you call on them and say, oh, I love this Donnie Brooks record, Mission Bell. Can you get Donnie to do our show? And they said, oh, yeah, he'll be in town in 3 weeks. And, okay, book him. Then I would play it for the 2 or 3 weeks before Donnie Brooks arrived.
Wow.
And that's sort of how it works. But we were so popular that, you know, the record companies would be calling us, pitching acts or pitching things that people who needed promotion or wanted to be on the show.
My point is, though, you didn't just look at the record charts. You had a lot of people on that show before they even made the charts.
Well, that was my thrill. I mean, it was wonderful meeting Connie Francis and Bobby Darin, who I admired, and Jackie Wilson. But my biggest thrill was taking a really talented young man or young woman who had a dream and who I really believe had talent and ambition. And it was my thrill to be able to present them on TV and back them up by playing their record and watching them climb the charts. That gave me my own personal thrill to be able to help new young people. I still do it today on my website, trying to help the underdog.
As I was reading the book, and basically I read the book from cover to cover, I had scanned it, but I chose not to really read the book from cover to cover until this week, so it would be fresh in my mind in preparation for this interview. And after reading it, I started to do a lot of thinking, and I'm saying, what was it that was unique about what you did? And the way I see it, I know it's not easy for you to say some of these things, so I'm going to say my perception is you were unique because, number one, you were actually not doing a show for kids, but you were actually one of the kids. It was like you were all together. You were all on the same team. You also danced. I don't think I could ever recall Dick Clark dancing. You could do songs. You could dance. You did interviews. Your show was unique in many respects. And then, of course, when you got to the Clay's Colbin thing, it became even more unique. You were very unusual, Clay, in a good way.
Well, if you're going to ask me about other things about my show, one thing that I'm most proud of is that almost from the beginning, we put stand-up comics on our show.
Yes, I forgot to mention that.
As a regular feature every week. And I was lucky enough because some of those young comics were Richard Pryor, George Carlin, John Biner, Fannie Flagg, you know, young, up-and-coming hopefuls, and of course they went on to become huge stars. They always say that I'm like a Dick Clark of New York. I'm nothing like a Dick Clark of New York. Our show had nothing to do with American Bandstand or that style of show. We had a very hip, sophisticated New York style show that nobody else has. It wasn't a New York version of American Bandstand, I'll tell you that.
No, it was not. I think your show was more informal. You could have been in the audience watching yourself.
Well, it's true. I mean, I love to dance, and I was young enough that I could dance with the girls, you know. And I even tapped on the shoulders of the black girls. I would dance with the black girls, and, you know, Alan Freed's show got canceled because Frankie Lyman picked a white girl out of the audience and danced with her, and the affiliate stations at ABC went nuts and canceled the show.
Now, actually, you just brought up an interesting point, Clay, and I was wondering, I read that part of your book where you mentioned that happening to Alan Freed, and then later on you're mentioning how you could dance with black people and nothing would happen. So it wasn't so much that the times have changed. They were out to get Alan Freed, weren't they? I mean, they were trying to get him for anything.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, there was also a difference in management. When I worked at Channel 13, I worked for the greatest management team. I've never been happier than those two or three years I was with Channel 13.
Right.
Eli Landau, the chairman, right down through the floor manager on my show, was encouraging, and they believed in me, and they gave me opportunities and chances. And when I moved to Channel 11, they were rigid, bigoted, they were restrictive. It was suffocating to work there, and I had to... Really, if my ratings hadn't been so hard, I wouldn't have been able to get away with it. But they just had to tolerate me because...
Your ratings were good.
I was their signature show. We were getting, 18, 20-point ratings.
I know.
And, we were beating Jackie Gleason some of the time. A few years, they added another half hour to my show. It became 90 minutes on Saturday night.
You're opposite,
we were
Jackie.
Opposite Gleason.
You're opposite,
we beat
the great
him.
One. Well, how sweet it was for you.
I know.
Put it that way.
So they couldn't mess with me because, I was bringing in all these sponsors, all this money, and they just had to tolerate me, but they sure didn't make my visit very welcoming or very happy.
Did it ever happen that you chose to have somebody on your show and they said absolutely not, and you had to not put them on, or did that ever happen?
Not to my knowledge, but Billy Vera claims that he and Judy Clay, he's white, she's black, and they did a duet together, and they claim they did my show and we never used the tape, and that did not happen on my watch. I looked it up, and they were...
I remember Storybook Children. It was
Storybook Children, right, and it was, they recorded it in 68, and I left the show in January of 68, so it was probably, after I had left, they kept the show on with a Canadian boy as a host, Peter Martin, who was absolutely the wrong choice. I mean, I knew right away they would pick the wrong person.
Yeah. And they try to make it seem like you picked them, and you really didn't.
No.
That was
well, that's another story. They made it look like I endorsed this kid. I mean, it was just right to the bitter end. I tell you, it even goes further. 40 years later, when Channel 11 had their 40th anniversary of their station, they had it at the Automat.
And
then when I was writing my book, I wrote to the president and general manager of the station right now, a woman. I'm saying, I used to be on your station 45 years ago. Could you look in your archives and find any photographs or anything? And I didn't even get the courtesy of a response letter. I mean, nothing's changed over there. They're just...
It's really sad. Well, yeah. Clay, you were on New York TV 1959 through 1968, and then during that period of time, you saw some great changes in the music. Of course, rock and roll was in full swing in 1959, but rock and roll started to change with the British invasion, and then rock and roll got a little bit more serious, and it got into elements that you were not too crazy about, like the psychedelic, acid rock, LSD, heavy metal, whatever, and we're going now to the late 60s, and did it happen like in a very short period of time that you became kind of disillusioned?
Well, I would always look forward to the Saturdays or tape days when, in would walk Jay and the Americans, or in would walk Little Anthony and the Imperials, or the Dupreez, or the Mystic, all my friends. And all of a sudden, people are walking in, torn blue jeans and sweaty shirts and psychedelic gear, and they're high, and they're... you couldn't relate to them. In fact, this newspaper article that I just see standing in front of me that I told you about, he quoted from the book the line that we're talking about, because I say, I was a black tie tuxedo guy lost in a tie-dye T-shirt world. And that pretty much sums it up. I was still... the old school show business, and all of a sudden these ragged muffins would come in, and the only one I could relate to was 11 Spoonful. They were great kids, but because they were New York Village kids, they were street kids, I could relate to them and talk to them.
But they had a sense of humor, too.
Oh, hysterical, funny guys, and really great. I just loved them. But other than that, I couldn't relate to these acts that were coming in here. I mean, they were, stoners and dopers and... God knows what. And I
And you were also pre-recording a lot of interviews, too, weren't you, at that time?
Well, we had so many groups on the show, they had to open up another day. We just taped so many groups. I don't even remember some of the groups being on my show. I mean, I got a picture of Jim Morrison and the Doors on my show just the other day.
You don't remember?
And I don't have any clue at all the day he taped. Right. I mean, the Doors, the Moody Blues, the Who, the Birds, they were all there, but I don't have a story. I don't even have a photograph. I mean, it was just too much, too many.
It was, and you just couldn't relate to the music.
Couldn't relate to the music. Right. I didn't like the music, couldn't relate to the people. Right. And I said, you know what? I was turning 30. And, you know, the mantra then was, don't trust anyone over 30. And I said, you know what? It's time for me to leave. And I think some young person should take over the show and do it. And, of course, they did hire a young person, but...
The wrong one.
The wrong one, yeah.
When you left the show, what was the show called at the time that you left it?
It was Clay Cole's Discotheque, but they changed it to, like, I think it was called Electric City or Electric Village.
Through all this, it went through, like, different
Well,
names.
Actually, Peter Martin quit after about 2 months, which I could have predicted, because he just was like a fish out of water.
They brought in someone else after him.
Yeah, Frankie Crocker. Very, very handsome black guy, which was very unusual. The station that hated blacks hired a black host, and he had a very, very heavy Rolodex. He could call on James Brown or anybody in the world. They all respected Frankie Crocker, but his show just died. After about 8 months, it went off the air, and for the first time in my life, I realized, you know what? They tuned in to see me. The kids liked me.
Wow.
Because when I left, the show just took a nosedive, and that was the first time in my life that I realized that, you know, I contributed to the success of that show. They liked me.
Well, it had to be bittersweet, though, because you had that feeling, but then you must have known that when the Frankie Crocker, when that did not take off, that was really the end of the Clay Cole show and all the remnants of the Clay Cole show as we knew it. Frankie was the end, basically.
Yeah.
One of your pet expressions is, weren't we something?
Yes.
And I'll say something, Clay. I mean, maybe that's rhetorical, but I'll answer that question, Clay. You were something, and your audience was something as well.
We were a good team. Me and my audience understood each other.
Now, we want to point out that you didn't really go into a cave for the last 40 years. We're not going to use the rest of this time to mention your pursuits, other than the fact that I will say you went into some other aspects of the business. You were producing, and you did win an Emmy Award.
I won actually two Emmy Awards for a pre-Academy Awards show with Joel Siegel in the entertainment category.
But you were basically doing things that were far removed from what you had done from 53 to 68.
Yeah, I didn't do any more.
It was
rock shows.
Far from the explosion of rock and roll. Well, we're going to bring the story up to date right now, Clay. The book that we've been talking about is Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 to 1968. Every single word in this book was written by Clay Cole. You did not have any ghostwriters. This is all yours.
David Hinckley was very kind to do the introduction.
That's the introduction, but I mean the book itself.
The cake for me.
Yeah. Once you left the show, the only person I believe, there might have been two people, because I know you did something with Bruce Morrow, with Cousin Brucey, in the 70s, I thought. You did a TV thing or something with Cousin
Brucey?
Well,
a friend of mine opened a spa, and out of friendship, I attended the spa, and Brucey showed up with a camera, so he did an interview.
That was not a planned interview.
It wasn't planned.
Okay, but the only planned interview that you have done in the 40-year period up until the present time now we're talking about was with David Hinckley.
Yeah.
Of the Daily News.
Well, I liked him, respected him, you know. He's the one that campaigned for many years to get the Shirelles in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's the one that campaigned that Jackie Wilson's burial site had no headstone, and he campaigned for that, and they got one. He's a real advocate of 50s, 60s music, a fabulous writer and a good-hearted man.
Let me tell you, he should campaign for, maybe he's already doing it, Chubby Checker and Neil Sedaka, people like that.
Yes. Getting into the Rock and Roll.
Getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Although at this point, between you and me, I'm starting to wonder what it all means.
politics.
That's a different discussion, and we're going to not move into that area. We're going to talk about what you are going to be doing. You have the book. The book just came out, and as I'm talking, your book came out yesterday, which was October 1st. I'm doing this on October 2nd. You are in Cleveland right now?
Well, I'm actually with my cousins in my hometown, Hubbard, Ohio. Having a book signing tomorrow, and then tomorrow night's our high school reunion, and I'm reuniting with the babysitters.
The babysitters!
I haven't seen them in 52 years.
Oh. Oh, man.
All bringing scrapbooks and photographs and sharing it. Then on Sunday, I go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You're going to be doing a big interview from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In 3 weeks, you're going to be appearing as a special guest at the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention, which is in Newark, New Jersey. And basically, that is an annual gathering of people who are either connected to old time radio or have no real connection to old-time radio, but people feel that people are going to want to see them anyway because so many of the people connected with old-time radio are no longer around. So they had to kind of diversify this, and it's really called the Friends of Old-Time Radio, meaning that you have some people that are old-time radio people and other people in the related media like TV, like Clay Cole, for example. You're going to be there, Clay.
Because I'm a friend.
Because you're a friend.
Radio.
A good friend. And you are going to reunite with somebody that was a regular, I believe, on your Wednesday show. You had a show on Wednesdays?
Yeah, for one season we did a Wednesday show, and then it moved to Sunday, a Sunday show.
Right.
With Tracy Day, who I absolutely adore. She's a singer with Bob Crew, and she hosted a bandstand-type show with Ed Hurst in Philadelphia. Great friend of mine I haven't seen in 50 years, and Chuck McCann is coming in for that. So
right.
Chuck and Tracy and I will be reunited with a lot of other old friends.
Yeah. A guy from the Jive 5 is also going to be there, the lead singer of the Jive 5, Eugene Pitt. And the same weekend that you're going to be appearing, you're going to be on the Singers panel at the Friends of Old Time Radio. That's a panel hosted by Stu Weiss, who is a DJ friend of mine. He hosts the Singers panel along with Brian Gary, who is Eddie Cantor's grandson. And that's on Saturday. And if that's not enough, you're going to be participating in events in Belleville, New Jersey, which is the home of the Della Kids, Frankie Valli, Tommy DeVito, and so many other. Connie Francis, yes. And speaking of Connie, they're having a special Belleville Gala. Connie Francis Gala. They're going to name a street after Connie Francis, and you're going to be part of that ceremony.
Well, I'm going to be the toastmaster of the final event, which is a gala dinner at Nanina's on the Park. Frankie Valli, Joe Pesci, Bob Crew, a lot of people who graduated or went to Belleville High School will be there, and we got a lot of surprises for Connie Francis. They're naming a theater after her, the street after her, and I'm honored to be the Toastmaster MC for the final big dinner on the 25th, which would be Sunday night. Public is invited, and all the funds go to the Children's Fund for Belleville, New Jersey.
And one more thing, you're going to also be appearing at a Beatles convention?
Yeah, it's the first time in 12 years they're reviving the Beatles Expo. It's going to be at the Stamford Downtown Holiday Inn, one full day on Sunday, November 29th.
Yes.
And Sid Bernstein's going to be there, Peter Tork from the Monkees, John Lennon's recording engineer, Sid Bernstein, I told you. And just a lot of fun.
It's going to be
fun.
Great.
Vendors, marketing, merchandise, stuff, and of course I'll be signing the book and bring a camera and we'll have some memory talk.
And I want to point out that Clay probably has other things up his sleeve, but you can't talk about them right now.
Yeah, well, you'll be the first to know.
At the end of your book, you have a chapter called The Party's Over, and you wrote something here. You're talking about George Gershwin, a Gershwin song, and you said it was Gershwin who wrote the song that has haunted me since I was a teenager, and you have the lyrics here, and I recently did an interview with Peggy King, and she actually did a live version of this particular song that has haunted you, and I'm going to have her start it from the lyrics that you quote here. We're going to hear just a little bit of Peggy King and Someone to Watch Over Me.
Tell me, where is the shepherd for this lost lamb? I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'd watch over.
And you close the chapter by saying, I like the words, I like the beat, save the last dance for me. And with that, Clay, all I can say is I cannot thank you enough for taking time out from what I know is an incredibly busy schedule right now and honoring me with the privilege of doing this particular show with you. It just means the world to me and want to wish you a world of success with your book. Once again, Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953. to 1968. Clay, you're the best.
Well, I can't thank you enough. You've been a really good friend to me in the last couple of years, and you've done so many nice things, and the help you gave me on the book is just you can't compensate the financial gain that you the time that you put in. But I thank you so much for being such a good friend and a good supporter.
You're welcome. We're going to close right now with what I believe, Clay, to be the definitive version of Shaboom. It's the one that I haven't mentioned.
Ooh.
When people talk about Shaboom, nobody can possibly follow this version of Shaboom.
I'm ready.
Stan Freeberg. Good night, Clay.
Good night, Ronnie.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
All right, hold it, you guys. This is a rhythm and blues number. You got to be careful or somebody liable to understand what you're singing about. You want that to happen?
No.
Well, then you got to talk unintelligible like me, right, Stella?
You said it!
Okay. Now, you guys want to sell a few records?
Yeah.
Well, then stick some old rags in your mouth and take it again from the top, okay?
Okay.
I don't understand the words now. Real mumbly. Life could be a dream. Shaboom, if I could take you up a bird's eye or fall. Shaboom, we will be done. Monotonous now.
Oh,
hey, nanny ding dong, shalanga la langa la langa la langa. Alec, I know your type. You're a troublemaker. We sing a Shaboom, right?
Right.
Then how come I can understand you?
Well, I...
What's the matter, man? Don't you dig gibberish?
Sure, but...
Happens again, I send you back to Hugo with the halter. Okay, you guys. Big finish now, huh? On your mark, get set, mumble.
Can I come in, dream?
Shaboom, hold it.